Shit Gun Productions. New media, new roles. This is Linux Outlaws, episode 215, for Wednesday, June the 29th, 2011. Bitcoin discussion. Everybody, welcome to a new Linux Outlaws. I'm Fab.
Hey, I'm Dan. Welcome aboard.
And we've got a feature-packed show for you today. This is the long-awaited show on Bitcoin. Lots of people wanted us to talk about this. I put it off because I wanted to research the topic because it's a very complicated topic.
I was just going to say it's really complicated.
Currencies and all that. I wanted to get some Bitcoins, which I got from people who donated them, to actually do something with it, to actually use it, to see how it works, you know, so that I'm not just talking about it, which I did. I did that. And today we will talk about everything. So I recommend you pause the show now and go get yourself a coffee or a tea or whatever you need to get your cranium going, because this will be hard work. This will be an in-depth technical show, probably pretty intense. And Dan, so I'm going to try to explain this. Whenever you have any questions, just interrupt me. I think it'll be good for the listeners, because I guess they will have questions as well. And just a disclaimer at the front: I'm not a financial expert. Far from it. I, you know, economics is usually not something I get into. It's not. I don't really find it interesting. I find it very hard to understand. I actually spent hours researching this, listened to other podcasts. I mean, there's some good podcasts on Bitcoin out there. The topic is quite en vogue at the moment. So there's a slightly older Security Now episode where they basically talk a lot about the technical stuff.
Okay.
If you speak German, there's a Chaos Radio Express episode where Tim Pritlov and some guest, I can't remember the name, but they go into it. They also go into the political stuff, which I also want to talk about. So I thought I'll try to explain what this is and how it works, and then in the end we talk a bit about the like political issues that arise from this.
Yeah, okay, sounds good. I think it'd be a good idea to, as you say, give a background first as to like the history of where it comes from and what it is and so on.
I'm filling a huge mug of coffee, so I recommend you do that too, so you don't fall asleep.
I've only got water, so we'll have to see how it goes. If I start snoring during the middle, then just, you know, wake me up or something.
Yeah, if you want to read more about this, there's a good Wikipedia article. Just look for Bitcoin on Wikipedia, or also Bitcoin.org, which is kind of the official site. There's lots of stuff on there. So yeah, should we get into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
So I think first off, we basically have to quickly explain about currencies, general currencies, you know, like our normal money. And people have to understand a little bit how currencies work, especially how fiat currencies work. That is what we have today. In the olden days, I know this because I'm a historian, so in the olden days, your currency was backed by gold. So the US dollar, there was a certain amount of like the paper money, you know, once they invented paper money, there was a certain amount of those paper bills, and they actually had gold at, you know, gold that was worth the same amount. That's where, you know, Fort Knox comes in.
It's the Federal Reserve, yeah.
Exactly. They had a huge storage of actual gold ingots at the, you know, for, because you have to have this because you're spending money and you need a guarantee that this is worth something. So the state was issuing money and they would give you this guarantee that this money was actually worth that amount in gold because they had the gold lying somewhere.
So, like, a good way to think about it, I've always thought, is you think of paper money as a... It's almost like an IOU. It's saying, like, this piece of paper proves that you own this amount worth of value in this gold or whatever it would have done traditionally. I'll let you carry on because I'm sure you're going to get to the point where they break the link with actual gold.
So the idea was this: you have this guarantee where the state says this paper money you have there is worth $1,000. And theoretically, you could always go to the state and say, here's the paper, I want my gold. You know, that was the theory behind it. And they'll give you the money in gold. Of course, what are you going to do with the gold then? But, you know, that was the idea. At some point, there wasn't enough gold. Like, the economy was outgrowing that. So they had to make the leap to something which is called I'm explaining this. I'm not an expert, so there will be stuff wrong. I'll get stuff wrong in this. So, you know, don't write me angry emails. I'm just trying to give a bit of an overview. So basically they would invent something that's called a fiat currency where now there's actually more money than, you know, there's more US dollars than they could have ever. Like there are billions and billions of US dollars. There isn't that much gold probably on the planet because the gold supply at some point ran out. so the question is, how do you know, the money is worth? You know, the US dollar you have there, or I have the euro, or you have the pound. And how do you know that's worth anything? Basically, it's all based on trust. You with your pound note, you trust the government of the United Kingdom, who tells you this is worth something. And you trust in that. Basically, you buy, in the morning, you buy your bread. And you wake up every morning and you trust that the money you have in your wallet will buy you bread. And there are instances in history where that fell apart. For example, in Germany after the war, my grandmother always told me stories how, like, a bread roll would cost 1,000,000 mark.
Yeah.
Because there was, you know, inflation and the money wasn't worth anything. So that is basically what can happen with a fiat currency. But in general, you just trust that this money is worth something. And you just have to, thinking about Bitcoin, you have to think, people think about Bitcoin, they think, well, it's so insecure, you know, you don't know how much this is worth. How can you trust this? But the thing you have to understand is with your normal currency, the stuff you have in your wallet, it's the same thing. The difference between Bitcoin and that is with normal currency, there is like a state behind it. With the US dollar, there's the US government behind that. You know, behind the pound, there is the UK government. And for example, the big change they made with the euro, which is one point why the UK didn't want the euro, is the German government is not directly behind the euro. It's the European Central Bank. Which is kind of all the euro governments behind. And for example, the German state, now you lose power because as a state, we come back to this later. As a state, you have enormous amount of power. You're the one printing money, right? And if you can't print money at will, you lose basically that's how they finance wars. You know, if you needed money to buy tanks for your war, you just print more as a state. It invalues your currency in the long run, but you can just print money. And with the euro, you can't do that. They all have to decide that we all do that as a whole.
Yeah, so there's actually I'm not really an economics geek, but I've read a bit about it. And the term for that is quantitative easing, when they print more money. Because we don't have the direct link to gold. It's happened actually recently in the UK and lots of other countries because of all the global financial situation right now. There's not enough money in the system going around, and banks aren't lending it because they're, well, in my opinion, mostly bastards, but let's leave that there. But banks aren't lending it, they'd rather sit on it. So in order for businesses to do business, they need to have cash that can be moved from one place to another. And that's where the term liquidity comes from. Like, if you have liquid assets, you know, you can move them, you can spend them. And that's what has happened in the UK was the government, actually, the Bank of England, who you're in charge of like the finances in the UK, printed more money to get more money into the system. But as you said, that devalues the whole thing, because if there's more of it around, by definition, it's not as rare and it won't be as valuable.
Yeah, and you just said banks are bastards, and this is where Bitcoin comes in. Because the idea behind Bitcoin is that it's an electronic currency, basically as the future. You know, we're all living on the internet, and you and me, we have talked a lot about the fact, you know, how hard it is. For example, if I want to send money to the US, it's a difficult process. It costs a lot of fees to me.
Yeah.
Even if I, for example, I send money to my girlfriend, who has an account with the same bank as me, and I'll transfer some money to her. It takes like 1 or 2 days for the money to get there.
Yeah, which is crazy.
And there is no real reason behind that, because it's all computers. The transaction happens in milliseconds. Yeah. The point is why it takes 2 days, that the bank is collecting all the money, and then they're speculated for with yeah. all the money for 2 days, and that's how, you know.
And
I mean,
they also get
take
interest as well.
Yeah, they get interest, yeah. They get fees, but that is also how they make a lot of money. Yeah. So people were really fed up with this, and it goes back to the 90s. They came up with all kinds of crazy ideas how to do an online currency. That basically all died. It was all like this crypto stuff and, you know, complicated stuff. That all died when PayPal came along, because at the moment where PayPal isn't a currency. PayPal is just basically a bank. It's basically an online bank. It makes it easier for me to send money to somebody else. Yeah. Basically, instead of going through my bank, I go through PayPal. I send them money from my bank, and then they can... The only difference between them and a real bank is they also don't speculate with shares and stuff, but the only real difference is they make it a lot faster. It's there yeah. in a second, and that's why it's used. And I personally don't understand. You know, PayPal is eating the bank's lunch. Mm. They're basically living off this frustration that people have that are like us on the internet. It's the internet. You can collaborate with people all over the world. Everything happens in milliseconds. We could like record a song right now together. We could collaborate. I could do work for you, right? I do, for example, I design a logo for, I don't know, let's say for Bradley, Software Freedom Conservancy. I'll tell him, you know, I'll design a logo for you. He tells me, okay, I'll pay you. I can design this logo I can do work with him in minutes. And we need this internet era needed a way to transact money fast as well. And that's where PayPal came in.
It also had a lot to do with eBay as well, because obviously eBay generated a way for people to buy and sell stuff very quickly.
I mean, eBay, in the beginning, now it's Amazon everything. You know, you want to pay your stuff. You want to get it fast. You don't want to wait 2 days for the money to arrive and pay a lot of fees. I mean, PayPal takes a lot of fees as well. But if you compare it with the fee I would pay to wire money to the US.
Well, I was going to say, I have actually found it less. I know lots of people listening to this have issues with PayPal and all this over WikiLeaks and all the rest of it.
Yeah, we'll get into that. That's the next point, yeah.
But the thing I've found with PayPal is, I mean, I've done work with people in America and other places, even within Europe, and trying to send, you know, money over a traditional bank transfer, you get the international bank number, the IBAN number, and you get this, that, and the other, and it takes forever, and it's really difficult. And it matters, like, instantly, I can just email you a thing from PayPal and email you the money. You know, that's what they call it. Technically, it's not really like that, but they call it emailing you the money. So I can email you the money instantly, and PayPal takes like 4% or 5% off it. And often it actually works out less than the fees I would have paid with a real bank, or, you know, if you want to call it a real bank, a physical bank that I can walk into. So it's a lot easier. And I don't know, I've often wondered about like the money laundering stuff and must go on through PayPal and so on, because I don't know how regulated it is, but I suppose that's
something
we'll
talk about
later.
Into that later. I mean, there's money laundering everywhere with real
banks
as well.
Yeah.
But the thing is, this PayPal thing that worked for a while. And, you know, people kind of lost interest in all these real electronic, real currencies, right? Because PayPal kind of worked. And then, you know, Bitcoin in the meantime got invented. Some guy wrote this is basically his thesis, I think. He published a paper.
Yeah, in 2008.
But the thing is, the paper, I think, came out in 2009, but whatever. Nobody really used it. because we had PayPal, like, that everybody was using that. But then I would say, like, at end of last year, I mean, people weren't feeling well with PayPal anyway, because they do weird stuff. They, like, freeze your accounts, and then you have to prove that you're really yourself. Then, for example, I can't pay with PayPal for anything that's, like, erotic kind of stuff, you know. Let's say I subscribe to a porn site. I couldn't pay them over PayPal because it's against their terms of service.
I never even realized that.
Which in Germany is stupid because it's totally legal for me to pay somebody to undress.
Yeah.
That is legal in my country, and if it's illegal in the other country where the person is, whatever sex they are, who undresses for me in front of a camera, that would be totally legal. But PayPal says, no, we're not doing that. And of course, it's, you know, it's their right. Their right to do that. So, and then there was stuff like with WikiLeaks, you know, they froze their accounts, and people were saying this isn't anonymous, and some dude at PayPal can just seize your account, and it's really hard for you to then get the money out of there. So people were getting really disillusioned with PayPal, and this is where they basically came back to big Bitcoin. So the idea about Bitcoin is that the central idea is that it doesn't have a central instance, basically. It doesn't...
The central idea is that it's not central. It's not centralized.
It's not central. we'll talk later about how anonymous it really is, but the idea behind it is it should be as anonymous and as privacy-oriented as normal IRL money, right? So the point about money is... all our bills, they have a number on there, but that doesn't get locked. That doesn't get locked normally. So yeah, it's totally anonymous. I can buy drugs with that. I can go out on the street and there's a guy who says, give me 2,000 euros and I'll sell you a P90 with ammunition, which would totally be illegal. But I can do, like, right, I can meet him in some shady street corner. I can give him the money. He doesn't know who I am. That's the whole point about money, right? You don't have to know who I am. You just know this money is, you know, this piece of paper with something printed on it is worth such and such, and he'll give me the goods. So the idea with Bitcoin was to model that on the internet. And so they actually used a peer-to-peer technology. The underlying protocol is actually IRC.
Yeah, it's open source as well, the software that was written. A guy called Satoshi, I'm going to try and say it properly, Satoshi Nakamoto is the guy who kind of came up with the white paper.
Yeah, and he has since then distanced himself heavily, so he's not the leader of the project anymore. I mean, you could think that, like, the banking establishment was, probably put a dead horse in his bed or something, because they really don't like this system. I will get to that later. But let's talk about the technical stuff. So the underlying problem with all of these electronic currencies is something called the double spending problem. Because as we know, you can, as the RIAA knows, you can copy bits freely.
Yeah. I would argue that you can copy paper as well. I mean, there are a count of money counterfeiting people. And I know it's not as easy, but it does happen.
But not as easy is exactly the point. Because the thing that protects you from paper money counterfeiting is that it's actually pretty hard to counterfeit it.
Yeah, they've tried over the years to add things like
they have all kinds of special paper, they have special ink. So it's pretty hard. So the thing is, you can do it, but you basically need professional equipment that is really expensive to do it, to do it in a way that it's not easily detectable. So
it's not as easy as me copying a file, a digital thing. I can right-click, copy, whatever.
If you have a file, if you have bits, you can freely copy bits. It doesn't take a second. So that's the big difference. I mean, you can counterfeit anything, but the real question is how hard it is to do. With money, the incentive to counterfeit it is incredibly high because you want to. You could just print money. And you want to basically eliminate that, because the double spending problem is, There isn't actually a thing called a Bitcoin. But let's imagine I give you a Bitcoin. I then just give that Bitcoin to another person. That would be the double spending, right? And you can't both have it. There must be a way to eliminate that, because otherwise I could just fraudulently spend the same Bitcoin 10,000 times.
Yeah, exactly.
So So there's technology behind that, and we'll get into that later. But you have to understand that the Bitcoin, after this whole thing, really took off. It's now, at the moment, there are millions of dollars a day exchanged in Bitcoins. Wow. Well, there's a site called bitcoincharts.com. I'll put a link in the show notes. If you go there, you see all the markets. The biggest market is something called Mt. Gox, which was recently hacked, was in the news. We'll talk about that later. But basically, they exchange U.S. dollars, and they currently have a volume of about half a million U.S. dollars a day that is traded, 25 million a month.
Wow.
So there's a lot of money being exchanged in Bitcoins right now. So the problem is, how do they do this, right? How do they prevent it?
Yeah.
How can they
fraud.
In an area where, you know, in the internet where bits are freely copyable, how can they prevent double spending? So the thing is, there's actually no Bitcoin, and that's just the name. Actually, there is no real currency. The whole system is basically a bank. It's a huge online bank. But instead of something like PayPal or all the other ideas where you basically have one central instance that would basically have to lock, right? It would have to have a number of every coin.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I spend it, they will have to write down, okay, Fab just spent this Bitcoin and you can't spend it again.
Yep.
And you can do that with signing and stuff. But the problem is that is a central authority. So Bitcoin works different. Bitcoin, the bank itself, the banking system, is the network. It's what they call a decentral bank, kind of a pun on the central bank.
Yeah.
So it uses IRC, and Bitcoin is basically just a big system of accounts. Like a bank, you know, you open an account and it just logs transactions. So there's no actual coins, there's no actual money, there's just transactions.
Mm.
And every transaction that you do is broadcast to the whole network. It works basically, you know, over IRC. It works like IRC works, or like news groups work. So you don't have to send it to everybody. You have a few peers your client connects to. I have my client running right now. I've netted it, so it has like 92 connections at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were to send you money now, I would enter a transaction that would get sent to those 92 clients and then just like get replicated over the whole network.
Yeah, and so in some ways it's similar to a lot of other peer-to-peer technologies like BitTorrent, say, where that could be a file, like a file of whatever,
yeah,
a piece of music, and then that would be replicated peer-to-peer. Everyone takes a copy of everyone else's copy.
Yeah, it's well, if you think about how IRC works, you know, if there's multiple servers, I'll send a message and that gets sent to a few clients connected to a server, and then that gets replicated. Like on Freenode, they have like, I don't know, 20 servers,
yeah,
and it gets like replicated. Everybody sends it on to everybody else he knows, and soon the whole network knows it. So the thing is, Bitcoin works in Bitcoin basically uses a global log of all the transactions. There's one huge log in there that has every transaction that ever happened in this network from day one. And this complete log by now is like half a gig.
I was going to say, that must be pretty big.
It's pretty big, and every client downloads that. And, you know, that's a problem in itself, but that's how it works. So the thing is, around every 10 minutes, all the transactions that have happened in this time get put in what's called a block.
Mm.
This block gets digitally signed and then put into that log. The ever running huge log is basically different blocks that are chained. So every block has it's like I don't want to go really into cryptography. Mm. If you're interested in that, listen to Security Now. But basically every block is signed with a hash, and the following block takes the hash from the preceding block.
Yeah.
So they're cryptographically signed, and you can basically, if you have the whole chain, you can verify every transaction that ever happened.
Mm.
So in that point, it's not anonymous at all, because everybody knows every transaction, and that's how the system works. And the thing is, it basically works like this. Let's say I have 10 Bitcoins. You know, just don't worry where they came from. Just imagine I have 10 Bitcoins. And the system knows the FAB's account has 10 Bitcoins.
Yeah.
And then you get a Bitcoin account. And I send you 5 Bitcoins. Then I create a transaction. And basically, there is no money. There are no Bitcoins. Basically, the only thing that gets recorded is FAB's account has 10 Bitcoins. And now he sends 5 Bitcoins to Dan, who has 0 Bitcoins.
Mm.
And with this transaction, FAB now has 5 Bitcoins. And Dan also has 5 Bitcoins. And that's it.
And it spreads that information through all of the different clients.
Through the whole network. And yeah. The thing is, the only thing that keeps integrity for this system is basically every client is interested in every other client not lying. It's like with real money. Basically, with real money, you're interested in that all the money in circulation is real money. You're interested in that all the money isn't counterfeit.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as you get a counterfeit note and you're trying to spend it and the bank sees, oh, this isn't real money, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
So most people don't realize this with normal money. So everybody's interested in this system working. That's why the system works. That's the trust.
Mm.
Not only have you trust in the institution that issued the bills, but you also have to trust that the money isn't counterfeitable. And the same thing is in Bitcoin. Basically, every client is interested in the integrity of the whole network. And that's why whenever one of these blocks where they basically take all the transaction that happened in the last 10 minutes, you know, I sent you money, you sent somebody else money, and 100 other people sent each other money as well. You get this block of those transactions put in that log. And at that point, every client tests all of these transactions.
Yeah.
And that's also why you have the 500 megabyte log, 500 megabytes of log.
As well.
You will. In the point when you install your Bitcoin client and your Bitcoin client downloads that log, it takes like an hour or something, because it'll cryptographically test all the blocks back to day one, and it'll verify all the transactions. So it'll verify that somebody sent somebody else money, then he sent that money. So you basically know every air quotes Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
You know where it originally came from, where it went. So you know that there's not like. The point is, if that weren't to happen, I could just say, I've got 10 Bitcoins.
Yeah, there's no way to verify it.
And then start trading them. But only in the moment, it's open source. I could hack my client to give me like 100 Bitcoins and then spend them. But the thing is, all the other clients would immediately happen when they realize when that transaction goes through, it'll see, FAB didn't have those 100 Bitcoins. Where do they come from?
Yeah.
So it'll cancel that transaction and kick me off the network, basically.
So I was just going to say, so what's the consequences for that? Would your ID or whatever, you know, would you be kicked off the network? And
I don't think you're kicked off because you can just create another wallet.
You could keep doing that, but
it'll just cancel the transaction.
No point because it'll never work.
Every time I give myself money that doesn't exist, the transaction will just get cancelled and that money doesn't exist because it's basically a huge consensus. It's basically like, it's really interesting. It's like a social experiment. It's like democracy works because everybody is interested in the system working. As soon as one client will notice something go wrong, everybody will go, well, I don't know where this money comes from. That transaction, basically it'll say that transaction never happened. Right?
Yeah.
It'll say, I don't know where the money came from. That transaction will never happen. So the thing is, how does this happen? The real question is where does the money come from, right?
Yeah. Because obviously at some point someone has to generate the coins and someone has to know
exactly.
Yeah.
So it started out with in the beginning the first person who wrote this program, Japanese guy whatever, got 50 Bitcoins, and the thing is. Every 10 minutes, we need somebody to collect all these transactions into a block and then cryptographically sign this block. Then all the other clients look at this thing happening, you know, this guy signing this block and say, yes, all the transactions are right. And at that moment, it will go into the canonical history, that long train running back to day zero.
Yep.
And at that moment, it becomes the official history. So all these transactions have really happened. The thing is, we need somebody to do this. And we can't all do it, right? Because if everybody would sign all, you know, it'd be chaos. If every client signs everything and everybody could fake it.
Yeah.
So we need every 10 minutes, we need a canonical answer, basically, to what transaction happened. And this is where the genius thing comes in, right? This is done with a hash. Basically, if you know what a hash is a mathematical algorithm that takes an input and basically condenses it down and produces an output. It's like a checksum. They use them for checksums on ISO images, for example.
Yeah,
so
like MD5.
Let's say I have an 800 megabyte Fedora ISO, and it spits out like a 15-character string, which is guaranteed to be different. If I only change one bit in that ISO, the string at the end will be different. That's what an hash is. Basically, yeah. It's a cryptographically strong hash, which means it'll condense it. The trick is it's a one-way function. There's no way to go back. So basically, I put in something, I get something out. There is no way by the resulting, basically by the result, there's no way to estimate what I put in.
Yeah, the hash will always be the same length, no matter if that's the difference. So if I make a file that's, I was going to say 15 gig, that'd be quite crazy. But say I make a file that's 2 gigabytes, which for a DVD image wouldn't be much. And then you've got a file that's 200 megabytes. The hashes will be the same size. If there was more characters on yours and I could guess how big your file was or whatever from the number of number of characters, then the whole system wouldn't work.
Not only that, but the important thing is that you can't go back. Let's go back from the ISO example. Let's say I make a text file and I put 4 characters in that. A. Then I hash this and I get a hash out and I give you the hash and I don't tell you what I put in the text file.
Yeah.
There is no way for you to know. The way, I don't want to go into how a hash works because I don't really understand it either. You know, listen to security. Now they explained it. There's lots of stuff on this on the internet if you're really interested how that works. But basically, that's what modern cryptography guarantees us, that if we have a good hash function, there is no way you can go back. So basically, if I give you the task, produce me a hash that comes from a document where I put in AAAA. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But I don't tell you that. Basically, I only tell you this is the resulting hash, and I'll figure out what in the document was. So basically, the only way for you to do this is to put random characters into the same hash function, right? Until you get the same hash out.
Like a dictionary attack on
a
password.
And because, exactly, you brute force it. Because I only showed you the hash. If you look at that hash, basically, you put random stuff in it, and when you get the same hash out, you know that's what I put in.
Yeah.
So if I never told you I put in AAAA, to figure that out, you have to just put random stuff in it.
And that's a really small example. How complicated does it get when you've got a massive file, you know?
Yeah, the thing is, it's not doable if I don't tell you how many characters I put in. Because you don't know. You'd have to start with A and then run through all the characters and then do AA, right?
Yeah.
So, but if I tell you it was 4 characters, even then it's hard because you have to run through all the combinations of the 4 characters. But you know it's 4 and you can start doing that. And this is basically what Bitcoin does. Basically, Bitcoin gives you the task. If you want to sign this block, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a known format. It's basically you take all the transaction that happened in the 10 minutes in a certain format, and then you put another string, you add another string to that, and then you hash that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now all the transactions are known, right? Every client in the system knows them because they're public, and the random string you put in the basically, that's just, you need to put a random string in there, and your goal is to have a hash at the end, comes out the end, where like all, let's say, the first four bits of that hash are zeros. So basically, you have the known stuff that everybody knows, and then you put random stuff in that, and your goal is to get a hash at the end where the first four bits are zero. So basically, you take this data you know, and you put that random string in there, a different random string every time, right? And you do, because it's random and you can't do the process backwards, your only chance of getting those four zeros at the beginning of the hash is to do this over and over and over and over and over again. Your CPU crunches away, does this millions of times per second, until purely by chance, by mathematical probability, at some point you then get a hash that has four zeros at the front. You go, "Ooh, I've got it." Yeah. And at that moment, you take that hash, you sign the block with all the transaction, and you send that to the network. And the first person who does this gets 50 bitcoins every 10 minutes. And that's where the new money comes from.
Yeah.
And that is what is called mining. That's what people do when you hear Bitcoin mining. They buy a fast computer, they buy GPUs, because GPUs are highly parallelized. They do this stuff really well.
Mm-hmm.
And they let them sit there and crunch and crunch and crunch and crunch. And they sign these blocks, and then they get 50 bitcoins. And this fulfills two functions. The first function is this keeps the network going, but because this generates that log, that huge long log that's basically that the network needs. So it generates this canonical listing of all the transactions.
Mm.
And the second is it provides a stable way of generating money. It generates 50 bitcoins every 10 minutes. And it's called mining because that's basically what they did with gold.
Yeah, people are going to dig it out.
Exactly. That's the way they basically generated money in the olden times. If you lived in San Francisco, you could go in the hills with a pickaxe and get gold out of the ground. But that rate that gold was mined was basically known. I mean, you know, there's a gold rush and then somebody discovers gold. But in the end, there was a limited supply of gold, and that's what guaranteed there's only this much money. And it like the amount of money we put into the system every year increases by the amount of gold that's found, basically. And this is what Bitcoin does as well. It artificially scarcens basically the amount of Bitcoins with this cryptographic function.
Yeah, so taking it back to the original point, so I can't just produce a load of bitcoins myself. I have to be involved in this whole process. And the other thing is, as you said, it's an incentive. The whole thing is just an incentive to keep the system going. Because without that, you're relying on people's goodwill and keeping this going. And I'm sure there are lots of people who would try hard to keep it going, but without that kind of financial incentive, almost,
we come to that later as well, because that will run out at one point. But the point is, this is how you make those 50 bitcoins. You make them yourself. Basically, you take all the transactions. If you find this hash, you sign the block, and you append one transaction at the end that says, "I'll get 50 bitcoins for making this block." And then you sign it, you send it off, and you get the money. The thing is, once you generate this block, once you sign it, and you send it out to the network, every client on the network will check this. They will check that the transactions you put in there really exist. They all know about these. They will check that the hash you signed it with was correct. So basically, you prove that you did the work, you did the number crunching. You know, that they check that all this is correct. And then it just, you know, they start the next block with the next transaction. And basically, that is how the money is generated. The thing is, we all know that computer power increases. Without any regulation on this system, there would be more and more and more and more and more money generated, because this doing these hashes takes a certain amount of time. If your CPU increase it, takes more time, less time. And the thing also is, the more people join this network, the more people try to crunch these numbers, the faster they get found. So there are two factors in the system built in from the beginning that regulate that the amount of money generated stays the same. The first factor is the network difficulty. This regulates that basically a block is signed about every 10 minutes. And this works, and you can regulate how hard it is to generate this hash by increasing the zeros that have to be in front of the hash. So let's say right now, I think right now it's like 10 zeros. I don't know. Let's say it was four. We said it was four zeros.
Yeah.
If the network now says it has to be five zeros, the difficulty
is increased.
Is raised. It's basically squared, you know, because it's one bit more. And the network itself decides, and this is like all the clients together, right? This is how the algorithm works. All the clients together decide how difficult it is to generate the next hash based on the total computing power within the network. Because every transaction is generated to everybody else, and because once somebody signs a block, we know exactly how long it took, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right now it's set up so that a new block is signed every 10 minutes. So let's say we have a network as it is now. There's so much computing power, and it takes us all. Every time a block is generated, everybody goes on and says, I want 50 bitcoins. I want to do the next block. And they all go off and compute, and it takes us 10 minutes till somebody comes back.
It's like a race, basically. Yeah,
it's a race. Everybody tries it, and just it's statistical probability, so it takes 10 minutes. Let's say the NSA comes along and says, we want a lot of bitcoins.
And they've got a lot of computing power.
And they have supercomputers, right? Yeah. And they put them in the network, and they basically half the... Because their computers are so powerful, they only take half the time than everybody else to generate the next hash.
Yeah.
So they will win. Like, the next round, when everybody goes out, they will win because they have the most computer power, probability, blah, blah, blah. And they'll put the next hash in after 5 minutes. And then the whole network goes, wow, this only took 5 minutes. That means our computing power has doubled in the network, or some, you know, might not be correct, but it's, I'm trying to, just.
Yeah. The system knows that the capacity is increased, if you like,
exactly.
The speed and so on. Yeah.
So in the moment where that happens, the system increases the difficulty of the next hash, and the difficulty only goes up. It never goes down. So basically it's a real complicated algorithm. Basically this keeps the number of blocks generated at one every 10 minutes. And of course it goes up, you know, at the end, more and more computers join, so it gets faster and faster. So at a certain point, then the system says, oh, it's not 10 minutes anymore, it's now at 7 minutes, right?
Yeah, we need to.
Or maybe even at 5 or at 2, and then it raises the difficulty, and then it'll probably take 30 minutes for a block.
Yeah,
but you know,
it's way back to 10 again.
Exactly. So this is the first factor I talked about. So this guarantees that as every 10 minutes a block is generated. And the second factor is, to keep the system stable, is how much money is generated. So the system is calibrated at there only ever being 21 million bitcoins.
The system, that's the maximum that can
that's
ever
the
be,
maximum.
Yeah.
It's capped.
Mm-hmm.
And basically it does that by, right now you get, when you crack one of these hashes, you sign a block, you get 50 bitcoins. But it regulates the number, and that amount will go down. Until you get zero bitcoins for doing a hash like that.
Yeah.
But it basically, it's at current thing, it's at the current growth, it's probably going to take 10 years or so until we reach that point when we have 21 million bitcoins, and then it's over. There's never going to be any more bitcoins.
Yeah.
This solves the problem of inflation because, you know, there's a fixed amount, and we know that.
Yeah, it's like the link to gold was, if you like.
Yeah, exactly. But this creates two problems. As you said, the link to gold. This creates two problems. The first problem is, what if we need more money, right? At some point, they broke the link to gold because they needed more money. The thing is, we don't really need more money because bitcoins are divisible to 8 decimal points. So right now, we are trading in one bitcoin amount, but you could see that at the point they become worth more, and I'll just send you 0.001 Bitcoin. And it'll look a bit weird, but that's basically how the system adapts to there only being a fixed amount.
Mm. That's interesting.
The other problem this creates is at the point where you don't get any payout, or you get very little payout for completing a block. Basically, completing a block is keeping the system working. You know, this generating hashes to sign a block, and the generating hashes is only there so it doesn't go fast.
Mm.
Because if that wasn't there, everybody would sign blocks all the time, get 50 bitcoins, and it would be over. So that's basically what's called a proof of work. You need to do some work. It needs to take a certain amount of time because we need to control that. And the thing is, that's work, and that needs to be done. Somebody needs to do this. Otherwise, the system breaks down. If we don't sign all the transactions anymore, right, the whole system breaks down. So what do we do at the point where no money is paid out?
Yeah.
And the solution to this is already in the system, because you can already pay voluntary fees for transactions.
Right.
And so I sent you a Bitcoin, I can pay a fee or whatever. So I could say I pay 10 Bitcoin cents or whatever, a transaction fee. And that money, all the collected transaction fees of those 10 minutes intervals, that gets paid out to the guy who cracks the block. Creates the block. So right now he'll get 50 bitcoins plus the fee. So at some point he'll get nothing from the system, but he'll get the fee.
Still get the fee.
And you can, at that point, you can imagine that the people who are mining will only, because they can basically pick and choose which transactions to put in there. And then the other people will pick up the slack, but they'll put in the transactions that have fees attached to them. So basically, at the point where there's no payout for mining anymore, you'll still have people who have computers running to do the work for the network, but you'll have to pay fees. And let's say if I pay more fees, my transaction will get picked up by those
faster.
People doing mining faster. So I can pay. So you'll see that at some point there'll be like a market. It'll like self-regulate.
There I was going to say, like, it's a free market essentially.
You'll have a certain fee for a transaction, and that will be a normal fee, and you can probably pay a little bit more and get your money faster.
Get it faster, yeah.
So this is what solves that thing. So basically, we've talked about how these blocks get generated and everything. The thing I didn't go into is that basically, with Bitcoin, we don't exist as a person. Basically, you get what's called a Bitcoin address. If you want to start, you know, selling or buying bitcoins, you get an address, which is like a long random string, and that is basically you on the system. And when you start your client at first, it'll generate that for you, and it'll generate also a public-private key pair.
Yeah.
And this is how everything is signed. Every transaction on the network is signed with a public-private key, so you can verify. That's how it's all verified in the end.
Mm.
And this is also what's kept in your wallet. Basically, this is the only thing, the only two things that guarantee you the money you have is this address, which is public. You know, I put mine on our website so people can send me Bitcoin, and this private key. The public key everybody has, but if I lose that private key,
yeah,
my money's gone. That's the only thing that basically, I mean, the money will be in the system, but nobody will be able to claim it.
Yeah.
It'll just sit in the system. I need that private key whenever I authenticate myself to the system.
Mm.
And that's basically what makes it secure. And that's also a problem. We get into that later. I mean, what happens when your wallet gets stolen, so to say?
Yeah.
So you basically have this address, and that master lock in the network, in the system, basically just keeps lock. It keeps track of everything. It's anonymous so far that it doesn't say, oh, this is Fab. It just says, like 17WEMZZ, whatever my Bitcoin address is. But it keeps track of everything back to the dawn of time. Everybody knows every transaction, where everything goes, everything is signed, so you can't break it. And the network checks all the transaction whenever a block is generated.
Yeah. So the interesting thing, I mean, as you said, maybe we probably get to that later, but the interesting thing for me about that is if I were to be able to somehow discover your ID, then I could know straight away by looking through the log exactly what transactions you've done and how much you've got out of it.
And we'll get into that later, and that's why Bitcoin as a, you know, everybody keeps saying it's an anonymous currency, that's basically bullshit, because it's actually not it's very, well, you don't know who I am, but once I put my thing on the website, you know who I am. Right? Yeah, you know, exactly, this is Fab. And you can then, there's a site called blockexplorer.com, block as in, you know, B-L-O-C-K, that lists publicly for everybody to see everything. So you could put my address in and you can see what money I get from whom. Well, from what address, right? But you can see
and
everything.
And when as well.
So everything's public, and that's the only way this system works. And we talked about, you know, the limited supply. We talked about the fact, I'm just going through my notes here. I made copious notes, of course, because it's really hard topic. The system, basically, as I said before, it keeps itself secure because everybody on the network has an interest in everything being okay. So every time block is generated, all the transactions are calculated through, all the hashes are checked, all the public-private key pairs are checked. Yeah, and that's how the system works, and that's all there is to it. Basically, it's just an incredibly clever how it's designed.
Yeah,
with all the crypto and stuff, but basically, it's just a big global bank. The thing is, it's decentralized, so the whole network is the bank. To say, you know, to invoke the buzzword, the cloud. The cloud is the
cloud bank.
Everybody sees everything. Everybody checks everything, and the amount of money and the speed that the money is generated isn't decided by some head honcho like in the American, I don't know what, their national bank or whatever, who prints the money. It's the network.
Director general.
Exactly. It's algorithmically regulated. There's only going to be 21 million bitcoins. They're going to be generated at, you know, every 50 or a certain amount every 10 minutes. That's regulated by looking at what's the computing power at the whole network, and then adjusting a difficulty of the process that happens. Well, there's basically in the whole network, there's only two processes that happen. There's transactions that all the clients do among each other.
Yeah.
And there is every 10 minutes, there is this block that gets signed. Basically, the global history is created. Mm. And, you know, that's the thing. I mean, that's the thing. Then there needs to be an incentive for that because somebody needs to do this.
And then every client also will download a copy of that once it's verified as well.
Yes, exactly. They all know everything. So that's basically how mining works. Basically, people buy a computer, like your client, you push a button and it says start mining. If you do that on a CPU, it'll take ages and it'll use more power than you get. Right now, you got to see right now, as we're recording, Bitcoins are currently trading at 13 euros per Bitcoin. That is at 9.75 pounds or at 1750 US dollars. So 50 Bitcoins is a lot. It's thousands of dollars. The thing is, currently it takes about a month to crunch that. So it's still doable because the thing is with mining is people have calculated that right now it's actually doable because you can calculate how long it'll take you.
It's still profitable, yeah.
It's profitable. You need to calculate how much money, how much power your computer needs over that time.
I'm just thinking, I'm sure you're about to get to this, but what happens when we get to the point where the difficulty is so high that it costs more in the power and computing and so on?
You know, I'll get to
right
that.
Down to the power than it you get out of it. Then there's no
the
incentive.
The thing is, that will meet the point when the payouts go down. You have two curves. You have the curve of computing power equals energy equals money you have to pay to the power company.
Yeah.
That goes up as the difficulty increases. And then you have a curve that from the other side or, you know, goes down, basically the payout, which is 50 bitcoins, which goes down as well. And when these two, when you can basically calculate, I need to buy a computer. I need to buy the best graphic card for the money that can, you know, that can power something. And you can calculate how much money you make. And at some point, those two curves will meet. And what happens then is we talked about it. Then, basically at that point, nobody will mine anymore. And you'll basically need to start paying transaction fees to keep the network going. And, you know, that's just how it works. What people do right now is actually they do, because it takes about a month to mine this, you know, on average to get coins. I mean, Steve Gibson got one in 2 weeks. He got lucky. he ran it like on his quad core and just got, I mean, it's the statistical, right? You could, you could find this hash after trying once. Or you, it's like passwords, right? When you brute force them.
Yeah.
It's like a statistical probability how long it takes to, but you could also get lucky.
Yeah, well, the thing is, so a good way to kind of link it back to the whole mining, you know, analogy, I mean, real mining, if I was digging something out of the ground, it's the, I mean, there is a chance, there's a very low chance that I could walk out and stick my, you know, spade in the ground and hit something straight away and go, oh, wow, look at that, that's just what I was after, a piece of gold. And, you know, but at the same time, if I have an army of 1,000 people all covering an area, which would, in this analogy, be similar to me having masses of computers and computing power, then I could increase my probability of hitting something because you've got all those people there. So, yeah, as you say, it kind of works out the same way.
Exactly. So what people are doing right now is like they do what's called mining pools.
Right.
Basically, it's like it's a central. It's you register with somebody who is organizing this. It's basically like Boeing or SETI at home, you know, folding at home, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Basically, there's some guy who sets up this mining pool who takes one of these work. It's basically workload, you know. You need to generate this hash, and creates little discrete work units that take like let's say 2 minutes instead of, you know. It takes this task that takes a month and chops it up in little things that take 2 minutes and sends you, need a special client that works with the GPU and stuff, sends you that work unit and everybody works on that. Then they finish it. The guy hands that into the Bitcoin network, gets 50 coins and then divides that through all the people that were actively working. And right now you can make money from that. I haven't tried. I'm not really interested in this because this is kind of the technical side, right? It's kind of fun. It's like right now it's what people are calling a geek sport. it's kind of cool to do, but I'm not really interested in this. I'm interested in Bitcoin on the basis of that it's a, you know, currency and that you can use it.
And as you said before, it's also an interesting social experiment as well.
Yeah. We'll get to that. So basically, you know, we talked about the fact that's basically how mining works. You know, the amount of bitcoins will decrease, and at some point it will just won't be profitable anymore. I have no idea when. I'm really not interested in this, but yeah, basically, if you want to do it, you need a special client and a GPU. And if you go to bitcoin.org, there's kinds of stuff.
So right now we're still in the gold rush phase, really. In that people are rushing in there to try and, because there's gold in them there hills, as they say, you know, and at some point people will say, oh God, that's been mined so much, there's no gold left. And
then we get into the transaction fee point. Yeah. And at some point there will just be nothing to mine at, you know, in 10 years or something, we'll have our 21 million and then that'll just circulate. One critic point of this whole system is that it wastes a lot of energy. You know, that, you know, there's people running GPUs, you know, that is not, you know, you can't just discount that. That's a good argument.
And the thing about it is that, as you've just said, because it's like a race almost to get these things done and be the first one to claim the coins, then there's going to be a lot of duplicated work because everybody's trying to race to the same point, and all those people who don't win have then effectively wasted the effort in getting there in some way.
Because
they didn't win.
Exactly.
Because they didn't win, and they're duplicating the same job that everyone else was doing.
Everybody does. Basically, it's thousands of people doing the same mathematical stuff that is just there to slow people down, right?
Yeah.
You don't do anything. You don't serve. You don't cure cancer as we're folding at home. It's basically just there to guarantee, because it's the only way. To go back right to the beginning, it's the only way to counter this problem that bits can be
copied.
You need a process. You need to come up with a process that takes a certain amount of time, and that, you know, that's that. So basically, thousands of people do this, and then one wins. because by accident or by lucky, whatever, you know, probability, they're the fastest. They get the money, everything starts over again. Interesting about this system is that it's incredibly resilient, being based on IRC. It's self-healing. You know, just like with normal IRC, if you have a net split and certain people don't talk to each other, the system then, once the net split is over, syncs up and exchanges all the data again.
Fixes it.
Basically, we could both have a transaction, and I sent you money, and you say, okay, I got the money, but be totally disconnected from the rest of the network, because, I don't know, there's some pipe broke down, and, you know, the whole USA for like 3 hours doesn't know we had this transaction.
Mm.
And the whole of Europe has whole different transaction. They have their transaction because, let's just say, some cable broke down. So the USA is doing transactions, we in Europe doing transactions, and we all generate all these blocks, right? At some point, the cable works again, and you think the system fall apart because there's one canonical history, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is, the system is written in a way that, you know, of course there have been blocks generated, but the thing is, the system will automatically, like, compile this, basically like Git, you know?
I was going to say, it sounds very much like version control. Yeah.
It'll compile this into one canonical history. Basically, it'll look at all these transactions, and then these transactions weren't signed. Let's say, both of us, we did like a transaction, and nobody ever heard of it. Mm. The rest of the network never heard of it, because we weren't connected to it for a week. And then we joined the network, and at that point, we can just say, oh, we did this transaction 3 weeks ago. And it'll just go into the next block.
So
basically, it doesn't matter when it happened. It'll just, you know, heal itself.
Exactly, yeah. It sounds almost, well, exactly like distributed version control in that, you know, it's the same thing. We could check out some code from somewhere and work on it between ourselves without telling any other the 100 developers working on this thing that we're doing it. And then we come back with our branch and whatever and merge it back in. So that's exactly how the whole thing works. Like the Linux kernel is a great example. I mean, how many lines of code are in that and how many people are working on it all around the world? Yeah. And it works because they have this merge. It merges and there are people who do this canonical thing which becomes the Linux kernel.
Yeah, exactly. And basically all the clients, it's exactly like that. Well, with the kernel, it's like it's real people. Like you have two patches, they collide and Linux sits there and figures out what needs to go where. Here it's basically automated. It's because it's the kernel, that's a bigger problem. There's lots of stuff that can happen. This underlying protocol here is really, really simple. There's just transactions going on. And in the end, the system just needs to decide, do I know where every Bitcoin came from? Basically, it just needs to figure out this trail for all the Bitcoins. And it'll just drop whenever somebody sends Bitcoins that didn't exist, it'll just drop that. And it'll
like
just
drop network packets or something.
Yeah, it'll just magically do this. It's really incredibly amazing. I mean, the guy who came up with this is a genius.
I was going to say, whoever invented this is like.
And it's like, the thing is, it's totally open source, right? He did this as a thesis and then wrote the client. It's an open source client. And
you sure it wasn't the Hawkman under an assumed name?
I don't know. Yeah, it could be somewhere. I mean, this guy.
It's the sort of thing he'd come up with.
The guy who did this, I mean, the name you just read out is before. It's a pseudonym. We know that. Nobody knows really who this guy is.
So it's,
and that's a good reason for it. I mean, the people who did this electronic currency stuff before, they patented their stuff.
Right.
And this guy didn't, because, and that's a good reason for this, because we just talked about all the technicality stuff, and now we'll get into the politics and all the meta discussion. But the reason for this is this, if this ever takes over, it'll put all the banks out of business.
Yeah.
Well, they'll still be in business for like speculating and, but the main business of a bank, which is exchanging money, is obsolete with this because we are all the bank is the network, the bank is the cloud, and we don't need anybody. It's like the typical internet disintermediation, right? We cut out the middleman. And this is why this guy is anonymous and doesn't, you know, and
I imagine he must be on the run.
And didn't patent this. Because, you know, the banking folks really don't like this. And now we get to the stuff why people wanted us to talk about this. I mean, I've now explained what it is.
We've really covered that. So if you
covered that. So basically, the thing is now there were lots of news articles about this, and people were saying, wow, this can never work, and, you know, this is like illegal stuff. And basically, it's all started out with Wired magazine writing an article about Bitcoin, but not because of Bitcoin, because of a site called Silk Road.
Mm.
And Silk Road is it's basically like eBay for drugs. It's a site that exists on the darknet. It's just, it's not on the actual internet. It's just a Tor node. It runs as an anonymous Tor node. You can only access it if you're running Tor. And basically, you can buy drugs, all kinds, you know,
online, yeah.
Coke, a hash. You can buy everything, you know, whole marijuana plants, and they'll ship it. They say it's like, I haven't been on there, but you know, I've researched this a bit, you know, on sites, and I read the White Archive and stuff. Basically, they say they ship it in a discreet package from Canada.
Like the pharmacies, basically, like those Canadian pharmacy things, yeah, where they say, so, you know, we'll sell you Viagra or whatever. Well, that's legal, so I don't know. But we'll sell you something illegal.
So basically, it's like Amazon or eBay for illegal stuff.
Yeah.
And, of course, the Wyatt did this, and now two senators in America want to ban. Well, they told the FBI they want the site offline, which the FBI hasn't managed yet because it's on the darknet and they can't really find it. Mm. But they're working on it. At some point, they probably will find them in real life and, you know, kill them all.
I was going to say, there's going to be some SWAT teams going into somewhere.
This put the whole spotlight onto Bitcoin because they use Bitcoin because it's generally anonymous. Mm. Now, the thing is, the US government wants to outlaw Bitcoin. And we're away from the technical point and we're into the discussion now, so I'm going to tell you my opinion about this. This is an opinion. My opinion is that the US government doesn't want to put them out of business because of, they don't want to get rid of Bitcoin or make it illegal because of Silk Road. Because you can buy drugs. I mean, this is just for geeks. This is people who are too lazy to buy their drugs on the street, right? I mean, if they take this site offline, I still, you probably know, and
doesn't
I
get
know
rid
because
of drugs, yeah.
Because I live in Bonn, in the town where I live. It's a small town. I know where they sell drugs, not because I buy them. I'm actually somebody who I'm like, the hardest stuff I do is I drink alcohol and I smoke cigars, and that's it. But you know, you can't walk down the street without seeing where they sell hash.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, I always get asked because of my hair and stuff. But so. They don't really care about that. The public might care, but they, you know, you don't get rid of that problem. I think they want to make Bitcoin illegal because, and this is very political and to me very interesting, because the US government doesn't want, I mean, the banks don't want Bitcoin, but the government doesn't want that as well because they cannot exert political pressure on this. The thing is, with the international banking system, the financial system we have right now, a state gets that. This was always the case. A state gets a lot of the power they have, not only from the police, you know, but and from their military. But they have a monopoly on printing money, and wars get financed, but just by printing more money, you get wars happening because somebody owes you money, you know. You get wars not happening because somebody owes you money. For example, the US could never invade China right now, not because they don't have enough soldiers, but because the US economy owes the Chinese so much money because they make all the electronics we use and all the iPads and that they just can't invade them because they owe them something. They could basically make their whole market collapse by the money they owe them. So the state doesn't want this monopoly of printing money taken away from it. They cannot.
It's a method of control, definitely,
exactly,
as you said.
They cannot control Bitcoin. And the thing is, why they can't control this, because there's no central, as we said, there's no central instance. The rate that money gets produced is algorithmically, and it's done by the network, and you can't manipulate it. The other thing is, you can't stop transactions. The thing you can do is, and Bitcoin isn't really anonymous. I have my address. It's on my website, right? So they know that's my address. So if I sell you drugs and my address is on my website and they know Fab has this address and, like, hypothetically, I'll be selling drugs, right? So I sell you drugs. The thing the German government then couldn't do is they couldn't stop these transactions. And with PayPal, they don't care, because with PayPal, they can go to PayPal and PayPal can freeze your account. They can stop transactions. They can reverse transactions. With Bitcoin, you can't.
Well, the other thing is, PayPal, interestingly, if you think about it, obviously PayPal is a company somewhere with an office with people employed and so on. So PayPal is very heavily linked into the old system. It's almost like a bridge between this new system. Well, in PayPal, it's the, you know, PayPal's money and virtual money and all that, as you said, it's very much tied into the real world, because it's got to have, PayPal's got to have a registered company, it's got to have taxes, it's going to have returns, accounts, all the stuff that every other shop on the street has that links them into this overall control system, in a
yeah,
way.
Yeah, so the thing with Bitcoin is it is a currency, and so, but basically it's just transactions like PayPal, but you can't stop it. The government, you know, can't stop it. The thing they could do, and the thing why I think this outlawing this is total bullshit, is because they can figure out who I am. Even like if I put my Bitcoin address on my website, it's very easy. If they want to stop these transactions, they go to my house and arrest me. They can figure out who the website belongs to and arrest me. And even if I don't do that, basically Bitcoin isn't anonymous at all, because you have an anonymous address and you can make a new address for every transaction, no problem. But basically you have to send the money to some address, right? And then you have to get the money out. So you have to do something. You have to go to an exchange, and we'll discuss in a second how that works. But let's say there's an exchange and that gives me euros for bitcoins. They know who I am. I have an email address or whatever. So you leave a digital paper trail. You leave a trail of bits that the FBI can just follow. Just like they follow, let's say, I don't know, the Colombian mafia and some, let's say gambling websites are illegal in the address in the US, and they use banks on the Cayman Islands, and let's say the New Jersey mob makes money from that. If the American police or FBI wants to figure out how they did, they just, you know, follow this trail. You know, somebody needs to have opened that account in the Cayman Islands.
And the funny thing is, there's a massive, I don't know, you're probably building up to this, but there's a massive loophole in real currency, which is cash, physical currency, because nobody tracks cash transactions.
Exactly.
And if I can always get a printout, which is non-traceable, which is what I'm doing when I go to a cash machine, I'm getting a printout, effectively, of the money that I own, or a little bit of it, and according to what my bank says. And then, you know, I can give that to you and there's never any trace. Then that's how the whole black market works. That's why when you watch films or even documentaries, when they break into some, you know, drug dealer's den or something, he's got a room full of cash, because cash is non-traceable.
Exactly my point. And that's why the whole, this criticism that is leveled by the government against Bitcoin is bullshit, because Bitcoin, there's a trace of everything. It's very different from real paper money. It's not anonymous at all, because you just have to figure out who the Bitcoin account belongs to, and then you can trace every transaction they made with every other person.
Yeah.
And there
in
is
many
a
ways,
way
it's actually more control if you had, you know, if somebody did have access. Say there was one central group at the back of the snake coil.
You can figure out who the account belongs to, because as long as I'm just trading bitcoins, you can't, right? I open a random account with my client, I trade stuff back and forth, but at some point, if I'm doing something illegal, I want real money or I want something. And this is the point where, like, Bitcoin transitions to the real world. I go to a website, an exchange, where I then change my Bitcoins against money, right? Or against anything else. And at that point, they can subpoena, they can break into the servers, they can log everything, you know, like with everything else. They can trace you, they can figure out who you are at that point. Of course, it's depending on how you do it, it's hard to do. But as you just pointed out, with normal money, it's even harder for the police to figure it out. And still, they do it, right? They know exactly where the mafia is. And, you know,
well, they have
they might not be able to arrest them all, but they have ways of finding it out if they want to.
Do you know, I think that the really key thing to remember here in terms of like how the police can track money and so on in the real world, and whoever else, the government's all over the place, with the current system, is look at Al Capone. It wasn't the, you know, it was, they didn't get him for like all the murders and things he did. They got him for tax evasion because they can track your money and they know that what's going on with your money, and that's how they got him. They didn't catch him doing a murder or something. It was, you know.
Yeah. So basically... So I think that criticism against Bitcoin is just, it's FUD.
Yeah, it sounds a bit hollow.
It sounds like I'm some kind of anarcho guy, but and it sounds like a conspiracy theory. But if you look, if you know, I study politics, and if you look into how much power a state has, because they can print money and they can dedicate what legal tender is.
Yeah.
That's why they don't like Bitcoin. That's the only reason. But, you know, we'll see how that plays out. We'll, at some point, I mean, like, the thing is, at the point where let's say the US government makes it illegal, it just becomes something like trading movies over BitTorrent.
Yeah.
And the thing is, the mob or whoever is buying drugs will still do it, right? Because they are buying drugs with it. That is already illegal. If you make the currency illegal as well, you know, they don't care. And the thing is, if you make it illegal, it doesn't make it easier to track. Your methods to track it, you know, are the same if it's illegal or not. So making it illegal won't change anything except, well, we just made it illegal. Wow, you're a good senator. You get votes. So, and that's the only thing they do.
Yeah, well, the thing that's interesting to me is you were saying about the exchanges and so on. At some point, unless, you know, everybody starts accepting Bitcoin as a currency, you know, unless like the shops start accepting it and I can go and buy my loaf of bread with so many bitcoins, and you know, like in the same way as something like all these sci-fi films we've seen for years and sci-fi stories like Blade Runner and so on, I have a thing with a number of credits on it and you swipe it, which is almost what's happening now anyway, because you're doing that with your credit card, or you're doing it with, now they were doing it with mobile phones, they want to do contactless payments with mobile phones.
Yeah, and that's the goal for Bitcoin as well.
Yeah, exactly. So, but the thing is, the key thing here is for me, the issue with Bitcoin, which I've never quite been able to kind of reconcile, is that we're all relying on the same way that we rely on the fact that our state gives our currency value, and I feel reasonably confident that the £10 I've got in my wallet will still be worth something to me tomorrow, you know, taking inflation and all the rest of it out of it and market forces, because then we're going to get really complicated. But the thing is, it all relies on this idea that it has value, and if Bitcoin doesn't have value in the real world where I can go and spend it, then it's going to have a massive hurdle to get things.
But
you know,
it doesn't have a massive hurdle because it already has value. It's traded at 13 euros.
Yeah, but the problem is, if the world financial system it decides that they're not going to accept, how do they trade these things? Because if the government's then said bitcoins cannot be transferred into dollars in our country, how does it? You know,
okay, that's a different problem. We can get into that, but. First of all, you have to realize that Bitcoin as a currency is just as the pound. I mean, the trust that is placed in that, the thing that people don't understand when I talk to them because of this, in the brain of people, they think real money and they think Bitcoin, right? And what they don't understand is that Bitcoin is as real money as your real money. Your real money is exactly the same. Bitcoin is even, I would personally place even more trust into Bitcoin because you can't have inflation, right? The currency is guaranteed to be stable by the cryptographic algorithm that it's built out of. And unless somebody breaks that or finds a way that doesn't work anymore, it's a lot more trustworthy to me than your state currency, because your state, for whatever reason, like, I don't know, the economy goes down or something, they change the value of the money all the time, right? Just print more money. They change the whatever. They can change the value of the money, and they do it all the time. So that basically itself in the system can't happen with Bitcoin. Of course, the exchange rate you have right now to normal currency, which has to be there, like normal currency in air quotes, whatever you're like, 2 euros or 2 pounds.
Yeah,
that could take. That is, you know, fluctuating right now, is wildly fluctuating. And people are saying, well, we can't trust in Bitcoin because that's fluctuating too much. Yeah. But the thing that I also have tried to point out to people on Identica over the last few weeks is that is all only because it's a young currency and because not enough people trust in it. And that will change. I mean, this happens with every currency, other more, you know, IRL, real-life currencies. If you look at currencies that are new, after the war, when Germany went, okay, we have a new currency, it's called the Deutsche Mark.
Yeah.
When the Kosovo wars happened, there were suddenly 5 countries where there was one before, and they all had their own currencies. At first, they fluctuate wildly, and then they kind of, you know, they kind of equalize. And now, I mean, our currency fluctuate every day.
Well, that's what the whole exchange rate, the ERM exactly. is for, the exchange rate mechanism and all that
and
stuff.
And that's exactly how it works with Bitcoin as well. So yep. if you go to Bitcoin market, bitcoincharts.com, that tells you how much a Bitcoin is worth. That's basically based on these exchanges. Mm-hmm. And the biggest one being Mt. Gox. That's the one that was recently hacked. And what these are, they're basically like black markets on the, you know, on the stock exchange. Basically, they're just an exchange. Let's say I have bitcoins, you have pounds,
yeah,
and you want bitcoins. Then I go there. I say it's basically like eBay. I say, okay, I'll sell you one bitcoin at £9,
yeah,
and you say okay, and lots of people do this, and this is how like this market establishes how much a Bitcoin is worth. Mm. And this is how this Bitcoin chart page, basically, it just looks at all the trades that happen that are public in the system, looks at these and says, okay, the last Bitcoin to Euro was sold at 12.75, you know, 12.75 Bitcoins for 1 Euro. So this is what a Bitcoin is worth right now.
And that's exactly what happens when you go to a travel agent, or if you go in the airport, yeah. and I'm going to say I've got so many English pounds and I want to change them into euros, they'll put up on their little screen, this is our rate, and they'll have their profit and all the rest of it, yep. built into
and,
that
and
rate.
That's exactly what happens at the London Stock Exchange.
Yeah.
That's how the international financial system established how much a dollar is worth. And the thing is, these fluctuations that you have them with normal currencies as well. Because at the moment when the World Trade Center got blown up,
yeah.
they had to stop trading for the dollar because the dollar was falling. Like, everybody was selling dollars, and it just goes down. And the same thing here. Mt. Gox was hacked, the exchange, and they had to suspend trading because suddenly Bitcoins on this exchange weren't worth anything anymore because nobody was trusting the site.
Exchange.
And so, at the point where half the U.S. gets blown up by terrorists, nobody will trust the Federal Reserve. So, okay, this currency is much younger and it's fluctuating more wildly, but at some point it'll just be like every other currency.
So the key question for me, though, is who runs those exchanges? So say that big exchange that got hacked, surely they must have an office somewhere or somebody in a room somewhere is running it. So they must have a trace in the physical world as well. So
yeah,
are they
sure.
known as well?
Well, the question is, I don't know. I don't know for this exchange. I mean, I know I use the bitmarket.eu, which is there in Poland.
Okay.
And they have an address on their site, and they take a little commission for running this. Well, actually, bitmarket.eu doesn't. They don't. They just provide this platform, and
right.
they pay server fees by donations.
Okay.
So basically, they just provide a platform, and all these just provide platforms. So they're basically like an escrow service. So let's say we trade, right?
Yeah.
I have Bitcoins and I did this to try it out. So basically we agree on a price. You'll buy 10 Bitcoins at 12 euros.
Mm-hmm.
You say, okay.
Yeah.
And then we have a transaction locked on that site. Then I wait until you,
pay.
Let's say PayPal or wire me 120 euros. And at the point where I got it, I push a button and you get the bitcoins.
Mm.
Of course, you could scam me. You could pull the money back from PayPal, but you know, this is just like eBay trading or whatever, you know, buying stuff off eBay. Of course, you can always get scammed. This is why, for example, Mt. Gox, they have an escrow service and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you know, of course, this exchange, they could just, you know, I have to send the bitcoins first so they can send it to you. So they could scam me as well, right? I think that's what you were on the, you know. But the thing is, this is with everything. This is just a bit immature because it's a new currency. I mean, if you go to this to a stock exchange and you sell shares, I mean, there's an agent that you sent money who then buys you shares. They could scam you as well.
Yeah, yeah, but that's what stockbrokers do. That's the whole thing, isn't it?
So it's basically the
not
same.
Not scamming, I should point out. I'm not saying stockbrokers scamming. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Their business is to trade for exactly. you. So if I'm if I was rich enough to have some shares in something, I might have a stockbroker. And if I wanted to sell them, I'd have to ring that stockbroker or whatever and say, all my shares or sell so many shares in such and such a company. Which is why in all the films you see people shouting on phones, you know, like, sell, buy, and in the exchange. Because that's what they're doing.
It's much harder for them to scam you because they have to be registered with the exchange. You know, they have their name, but it happens as well. You know, there's millions of dollars get scammed that way every year. Banks get robbed, and the same thing with Bitcoin. The thing is, right now, okay, these are people in Poland somewhere, and the site could disappear tomorrow. Of course, but also this is a very young system. And if you look at what happened in the international monetary system around 1900, you know, there were lots of people scammed and stuff, much more than now, because it's a much mature system, and you could think that this whole system would mature as well.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say. So it seems to me that over time, if Bitcoin continues to, you know, stay around and all the rest of it, over time, then in the same way that that one place in Poland is very popular at the moment, this one kind of exchange, they will build up a reputation over the years of being trustworthy, and then they might set up like branches. If you think about it, like a real bank, they might have branches of the bank, and they might be in different countries and so on. And then they build up in the same way that when I go and put my money into, I don't know, Barclays Bank or something in the UK, or you put it in Deutsche Bank in Germany, we trust the fact that because it's been there so long and because there are so many branches and it's got this international thing it's not going to disappear overnight, that we're not going to come tomorrow and find that the bank's shut and our money's gone.
Well,
it could actually happen, and it has happened that banks have folded over the years.
And so, to turn it, and then all your money's gone, right? If you look at Greece.
Yeah, exactly.
People were taking their money out of the bank because they were afraid that the bank would fold and their money would be gone.
Yeah, they have a run on the bank, as they call it.
Exactly, and that happens. And you can turn it around. You could see if Bitcoin takes off, you could see Deutsche Bank doing what Mt. Gox does now. Because they already do this. They exchange euros for dollars, for example. That's one of the things a bank does. And they could just the same exchange Bitcoins to euros.
Yeah.
And at that point, it'll be much more trustworthy because you have Deutsche Bank there. And they just can't, I mean, they could shut down, but they could do that now as well. But they can't just disappear with you know where they are.
Yeah, exactly. and this is the whole argument right now about bank regulation, particularly in the UK, because we've had this massive banking crisis where people were doing stupid things and not being responsible and so on in the banks
ridiculous
profit.
I think the moral of the story is Bitcoin is a currency like every other. It works totally different in a way, and that's the last point I'll have. It's a big experiment in one way, but generally it's a currency like every other. And it's as people ask me, should I trust this, blah blah blah, or I don't trust this. You can trust this as much as you trust every other currency, and there's currencies you trust more. You know, people trust the US dollar a lot more than they trust the, I don't even know, North Korean whatever, or the Himalayan yak dollar or whatever, right? Yeah. And that's why
the GNU cash. What was that GNU cash that Richard Stallman was making?
That's why the exchange rates fluctuate, right? When the World Trade Center gets bombed, people think, oh God, the USA, they'll be gone in 50 years. I don't trust their money anymore. I'll trade in euros, you know? And this changes, and Bitcoin is just the same thing. The difference is it's immature right now. It's very young. It seems to work. It seems to do everything it should do, but we don't know. The whole system could collapse tomorrow, just like the banking system could collapse tomorrow.
Well, it very nearly did, and it has.
Yeah, and it does every 100 years, basically.
I was going to say the 1930s in America when they had the crash, stock market crash.
So it's basically, it's just very different, but it has it has some downsides, like we said, and it has some upsides. The outside, it's very fast. It's internet-based. It's basically currency. That's why I find it so interesting, and I wanted to take off because it fits our new lifestyle, basically, on the internet. It fits this micropayment idea, you know, the Flatter idea. It fits the I want to send you money now, fast idea. The downside is, and this is something that was also discussed, you know, somebody got $500,000 supposedly stolen in bitcoins. I linked that in the show a week back or so. The thing is, if you install this on Linux, in your home directory, you have a directory .bitcoin, and that has your wallet. It's your private key in there. And if I get access to your computer and I get that directory, I have your bitcoins. And I can transfer them, and then they're mine. Thing is, people are saying, wow, this currency is never going to take off because of that. The thing you have to remember with Bitcoin is the one difference to all the other stuff is, well, it's not really a difference, but you're basically your own bank. And, I mean, it's called a wallet for a reason. If you put all of your money in your wallet and you walk down the street and somebody steals your money, your wallet, your money's gone. That's, you know, real money. It can't be traced. It's the guy who has the paper it's printed on has your money. And in the same way, the guy who has your private key has your bitcoins. So I don't actually see that as a downside per se. It's just a shift. Basically, you have to protect this directory.
But there is a difference. There is a crucial difference, though, in that I don't walk around with all of my money in my wallet in cash. If I did, it would be very easy for people to rob everything that I have. So in the same way, it seems to me you will have to have different wallets, virtual wallets now, I'm talking about in the Bitcoin sense, and maybe not put all of your money in one wallet, because then, you know, if that wallet gets stolen, then you've lost all your money.
The one crucial difference here is that... what I mean with you are your own bank is, let's say you do online banking and you have a Windows computer and you get a Trojan and it steals your banking credentials. Happens to thousands of people all over the world every day.
Yeah.
The thing that protects you is that your bank, you pay them fees. And if this happens and somebody steals all your money out of your account, they'll basically give you the money back. Because there are laws for this, and that's why you pay fees, they basically insure you against this. They actually have insurance. Banks have insurance. They put millions of dollars aside every year for this kind of thing, and they still make money. That's why they, you know, that's why they take fees. But this insures you. But the technical system itself isn't more secure. You think your four-letter PIN number for and your 10 list that you probably save in your computer is secure? Right? And...
yeah.
The normal banking isn't secure. I could do social engineering, ring up your bank, pretend I'm you, change my address, and get a PIN number mailed, a 10 list mailed. That happens all the time.
Put up a fake website that looks like it. You don't even have to phone me. You know, so you just send me a link and say, "Oh, we need to get you verify your login details," and that happens all the time. These phishing attacks.
Phishing, spear phishing. But the thing is that our financial system is built with our laws in a way that your bank insures you against that. And with Bitcoin, you don't have that. But the thing is, that's a technicality. You could see a website. Let's say somebody opens Bitcoin, and this exists already. You put your Bitcoins into this online bank, right? They have your private key, and you do transactions through them, and you pay them fees, and the same thing happens. If somebody hacks it, they give you the money back. And you could see them making money like a normal bank, basically. If you transfer bitcoins, they're keeping them in escrow for a bit and then speculate with that.
Yeah.
For example, something like that. I mean, and that would be, and the cool thing with Bitcoin is you don't have to do that. So you can transfer money immediately, and you don't have to deal with those stupid banks and their fees and everything. But that power comes with responsibility, and that responsibility is that you keep your wallet secure. And I mean, you can encrypt it, you know, TrueCrypt. There's ways of protecting this, but you have that responsibility. But you could also see for this to reach mass market that, I don't know, PayPal or like another site creates a service around that. And then it would be more like normal money.
Yeah, it would. And the interesting thing for me is that the whole thing, as we've said, relies on this trust and so on. And we've talked about the current kind of financial system and the way it works with different governments. You've got the IMF and all these other bodies that we don't really know much about, and we don't elect them and whatever. So anyway, I'm getting very political there. But yeah, so the thing is that I don't think that the powers that be, if you like, you know, fight the powers that be, to take the public enemy stance, you know, they will never accept any currency that they cannot control, because it's a system of control, as I said, and government is about control. And I'm personally not an anarchist, so to whatever degree I agree that we should have a government and there should be some system of control. I mean, that's a really big argument that you could spend a long time talking about. But I don't think the problem for Bitcoin is, until I can spend it in what I see as the real world, like put petrol in my car or buy bread or whatever, you know, then and that, for that to happen, the governments would need to buy into it,
no,
and they never will,
no,
because they will,
no,
never trust it, because it gives up their control, which they're never going
to
do.
But you don't have to. The whole thing with Bitcoin is that we don't need the government to accept this, and it works. I mean,
well, we don't.
You can spend
petrol
money.
Station starts to accept Bitcoin.
No. Somebody donated Bitcoins to me, and I went to bitcoinmarket.eu. I created an account. I gave them. I sold Bitcoin to somebody, and they sent PayPal. They PayPal'd me money, and I sold Bitcoin, and I got money back. So it works right now. And not only that, if you go to bitcoin.org, there's a huge list of people who accept basically PayPal, Bitcoin payments.
Yeah.
And they'll do something for you. There, you can buy root servers, you can buy Mumble servers. I mean, right now it's mostly geeks, and it's
yeah, well, that's what I mean. At the moment, it's great if I want to buy stuff online.
No. At the moment, you can exchange it for money, hard cash, cold hard cash.
But at that point, then aren't you just saving it in the old system? And you know, it seems to me that people are rushing to convert their Bitcoin. Not rushing, you know what I mean? People are, for me to do anything with these Bitcoins, I have to convert them again into whatever my country considers a currency, and then they still have the control. So we still need the government, because we need that currency, unless everything would accept the Bitcoins as they are, and you know, that would be our currency, our national currency, then there would always be a government involved.
I don't think that will ever happen, and it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, that's my point. I don't think it'll ever happen.
Yeah, but the thing is, your argument is basically Bitcoin is not legal tender. And what I mean by that is, legal tender in the UK is the British pound, and it's your only legal tender. And legal tender means, if you go to a bakery and you want to buy a bread, and they'll tell you the bread is whatever, and you say, okay, it's £2, and you give them £2, they have to accept that money. That's what legal tender means. Legal tender means, if I pay with euros in Germany, they have to accept that money. But the currency doesn't have to be legal tender. It's something, the thing is, it doesn't happen these days, but it
That's like a barter system, is what you're talking about, effectively.
What you're saying is if
we exchanged, like, at the moment we're exchanging these things, as we've said, currencies that we believe have value and for whatever reason, and you can redeem them for other things. But in the old days, before we had banks and before we had money, I'll give you three goats if you, you know, build
you don't
me a
have
barn
to go to far back as that. You could go to your bakery and pay, like, if they wanted, and pay for your bread in US dollars. And in the beginning of Germany, when the mark was young, and you know, Germany used to be divided in all these allied zones, it was totally lots of people had US dollars.
Yeah.
And you would go to somebody and pay them in US dollars. And I could do that today. I could go to a big shop, and they do this for tourists. I mean, they have a bad exchange rate, and they take a lot of money because basically they need to exchange the money. But you can go to, I don't know, not Aldi, but like, let's say a big shop like Kaufhof in Germany, and you can, sometimes they have signs, we accept US dollars if it's somewhere where the US Army base is near. The thing is, the difference with legal tender is, you can't force them to accept your money. And And the same thing is with PayPal. That would have been the same argument against PayPal taking off, because, I mean, PayPal is not a different currency, but basically it is.
Yeah, it is.
On the internet, it's not a real currency, but basically you can't force anybody to accept PayPal. And in the beginning, nobody accepted PayPal. And then, you know, eBay pushed it and more people, and they got users, and you get to a critical point where sites then decide you can pay via PayPal. And these days, you can pay nearly everywhere via PayPal.
Mm.
And the only thing that keeps Bitcoin from reaching that is basically it needs critical mass, and for that, it needs trust. So if this...
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Everyone's got to buy into it, if you like.
Yes, but the thing is, the state doesn't have to. That's my point.
Well, that's what I mean. If everybody buys into it, taking, you know, whatever the state out of it, you know, if everybody in the population of the world buys into it, then it will work brilliantly.
And the jury's still out if this will happen, right? I can see it happen, because for the simple reason that lots of people have problems with PayPal. And I mean, right now Bitcoin is a geek thing, but you know, who cares behind the technology behind it? If somebody writes an easy client that is that easy to use, and you know, why not? I mean, it immediately, nobody needs to care that there's a distributed system behind it and how mining works, and that's all totally uninteresting. Like, nobody is interested in how PayPal exchanges your money, you know, how they actually do it, you know, what they do. The thing with PayPal is it's a name, it's become known, people trust
it's a brand,
to a certain degree, and they use it. So, and
they trust it in the same way that they trust a bank, as I said to you. So, say Deutsche Bank, because it's a name, they know it, they've seen it a lot, it's been around a long time.
And same the exact thing. Same thing could happen with Bitcoin. I mean,
it could, yeah. But I think the reason I'm slightly pessimistic about the future of Bitcoin is not that I don't think it's good. I think it's a brilliant technology and I think it works. I think, if anything, it's more destined to become a geek currency because I'm not convinced that someone will build the interfaces, if you like, to the other people who are outside the geek community, and they will buy into it. I don't know. That is something that none of us can predict. Maybe they will. I hope I'm wrong. I hope they do. But I just don't see it happening.
Well, okay. Yeah, sure. I mean, the thing I think, I mean, for me, I don't know if it's going to take off. I think I would like it to take off, because I think it's a brilliant system.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it
solves
agree,
the problem that we had, right?
Mm.
We had people who wanted to donate to our podcast, and we had hundreds of people tell us they don't want to use PayPal.
Yeah.
Right? We went out, we tried to set up Google Checkout.
Yeah.
Didn't work.
No,
and
really.
With all these systems, you have the problem that there's one entity behind that, PayPal.
Yeah.
The company could go bust. They could get bought by Microsoft.
Yep.
They could blow up. You know, Google Checkout. They have their terms of service, and then you can't do donations. And for example, or PayPal right now, you can't sell Bitcoins over PayPal. Actually, if you tell them that the thing you just bought was Bitcoin, they'll cancel your account.
Wow,
because obviously they don't like Bitcoin, because
it's
killing their market. But see, stuff like that, PayPal can just say no, we don't take your money if you have a Muslim name. If you have an L in your name, or like your first name is Muhammad, we're not going to take your money.
Or if we just don't like the country that you're in, you know, because I've seen that happen.
Yes.
Like, I mean, we had the business of people emailing us who listened to the show in places like Syria, who were getting cut off from US websites because the US government suddenly decides that, you know,
and
they don't like their country
or
whatever.
This is why I could see Bitcoin taking off. And the thing with Bitcoin is, it's been there for a while, nobody has used it, and I think it won't go away. If nobody cracks the algorithm, I mean, there could be more bad press, and the share price goes down, and Bitcoins are not worth a lot, but it'll never go away, right?
Yeah.
It's like the atomic bomb. It's been invented, and I mean, the US government could outlaw it, but it'll never go away. Or our government, every government could outlaw. It'll never go away. At some point, it's like 50-50. It could happen that the old governments outlaw it and become like a hacker, pirate, underground, illegal thing.
Mm.
Or it could happen that, like, PayPal blows up in the next year.
Yeah, it's possible.
And they do, like, they did the thing with WikiLeaks and they pissed all the geeks off.
Mm.
Let's say they do something and they piss all the normal people off. Let's say they get hacked and all the money is gone, right? Let's say people figure out that they steal everybody's private information, like Facebook or something, and then everybody suddenly says, well, look, this Bitcoin thing. And the thing with the Bitcoin thing is one thing that will never change is that it's a distributed system that nobody has central control about. And that's the point I actually want to end with, because, I mean, this discussion, you know, we have no conclusion. We'll have to see how what.
Well,
what
as does. I said, we can't predict the future,
Exactly. The point I want to end with is Bitcoin is actually really a huge social experiment, if you think about it.
It is, yeah.
It's... Actually, and I heard on Chaos Radio, they said it's basically it's an experiment in anarcho-capitalism. Mm. Because lots of people that back Bitcoin are like real leftist people who think the state shouldn't be involved in, you know, libertarians, people who think the state shouldn't regulate the economy. Because in economy, there's basically two schools of thought. One is the state has to regulate it, and the other one is, no, that's really bad. If the state regulates it, we'll forever have the thing we have now, where like every 70 years, there's a bubble and everything breaks and everybody loses all their money, and then the cycle starts over again. And the thing is, with Bitcoin, that can't happen, because no state controls this. The currency can become worthless, but in a relation to another currency, it can become worthless. But once you have Bitcoins, nobody can take these away. It's not like the state can say, we don't like the dollar anymore, it's worth nothing, here's our new currency, it's the cyber dollar.
Yeah,
and we give every you know, like they did in Germany after the war, you know, your money's worthless, we'll print new money.
Yeah.
And the thing is, with Bitcoin, actually, that can't happen, because there's no central authority. As long as there's people using the system, generating these blocks and signing them, the system will go on.
Yeah,
and I think that's just
it is incredibly cool. It's and just, I gotta say, like as we've already kind of mentioned, that the person who thought of this, you know, God, they must be incredibly clever, because this could be, it could be, I agree, but it could be an invention that changes the whole world. But I don't know. As you said, we can't predict the future. I don't know. I think my view is that the powers that be have ways to try and make your life difficult, and they will make Bitcoin go away, or they will make it limited to a certain small group of people in some way. They'll find a way. But I don't know. I hope I'm wrong. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, I think they will certainly try. Like, the state level will try.
Mm.
But I think, like, if you take out of account the people who make the politics and the financial system, everybody else should be interested in using this.
Mm.
Because this solves problems we all had. We were all whinging about problems for years that this solves. And the banking establishment, we can't change. We have no power to make them like Bitcoin.
No.
And they don't, they want to. But the politicians...
Yeah, you could vote. Yeah, if you can vote.
Conceivably... If enough people say we want Bitcoin, even if they outlaw it tomorrow, those laws can get changed. And the thing is, Bitcoin won't go away. That will still be there. So maybe at first there'll be a reaction where nobody, you know, where it get outlawed, and then maybe it'll come back. I don't know. I think the actual, the bigger hurdle for Bitcoin as an idea is that people don't trust it.
Yeah.
And this is based on the fact that people do not understand what money is.
Mm.
And you know, if you've been around Jan Wildeboer, he is his friend who wrote a book on Georg Zocher, who wrote a book on basically money and politics of money. I haven't fully read it. I read some extracts. It's, you know, I'm as you've heard, I'm not like really economist and stuff, but he has a lot of these theories as well. And he founded this transnational republic thing, you know, that we talked about as well. And Bitcoin is something that fits right into that. It's Jan always says the future is decentralized. You know, Twitter is crap. We need decentralized microblogging. We need StatusNet. And basically, this is the whole idea about currency. You know, normal state-run currency is crap. We need a decentralized currency. And the thing is, it's an incredibly powerful idea and it's really cool, but people don't understand this. People don't understand how their money works. They say, oh, Bitcoin's worth nothing. It's just on the internet. But here, you know, I'll check my wallet out. Yeah. And I've got these jingly coins.
And I've got this
nice, colorful paper that, look, that has a signature on it from some dude from the European Central Bank. Mm. It's got to be worth something.
Mm.
But they don't understand that this isn't, you know, inherently it's not worth or more trustworthy than Bitcoin is.
Yeah, but
I think not enough people are intelligent enough to understand this.
Yeah, well, that's the problem. That's what I'm saying. Will people ever be able to get the idea and embrace it if they can't, you know, I don't know. I hope they will.
We'll see.
So it seems
we'll
to me...
We'll keep an eye on it.
This is a very... It's been a long and very kind of in places philosophical discussion, but it seems to me that all of these things boil down to almost in a programmer's kind of way. I'm thinking of objects and all this classes and so on. You know, they all boil down to ideas. They're all ideas. This currency that we have in the real world is an idea that we believe in for certain reasons. And there's this theory that you can't kill an idea. You know, you can, as long as it's alive in someone's
signal.
As long as it's alive in somebody's mind, the idea never goes away. And this is the problem that, you know, authoritarian regimes in all lots of countries have, is that you cannot kill an idea. As long as somebody holds it and it can be transmitted and it can be, you know, multiplied by millions, then you can never kill it. So the thing we need is for enough people to buy this idea and, you know, believe in it, because that's where its worth comes from. Just as our money's worth comes from the fact that we all believe in it, we'd have to believe in Bitcoin. This sounds more like a political kind of vote for me kind of speech now, but you know what I mean? If you voted for Bitcoin, if you believed in it, and if enough people believe in it, then it could happen. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, I think you basically
summed it up.
You can end the show on that. You summed it up very well.
One more thing I wanted to mention. This is just a little reference back to something earlier. It won't keep it going much longer, but we were talking quickly about the current accusations against Bitcoin that it's used for illegal activity and so on. There's a fantastic book by Eric Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation. He's kind of an investigative journalist. He wrote this book, and I don't know why, but it's called Reefer Madness is the name of the book. But what it's actually about is the black market, and the subtitle is Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. And if you want to know a little bit more about how the black market works, in his opinion, but he seems to be very well informed, in America particularly, and how all the drug business works and all that kind of stuff, and how it actually interfaces to the real economy, and how valuable the black economy is to the real American economy. Really fascinating stuff. Go and check out Reefer Madness. It's from 2003. It's written by Eric Schlosser, and I'll give you a link for the show notes.
Yeah, I'll put a link in the show notes.
So that's it.
Definitely.
Yeah, that's all I wanted to quickly work in there.
And I think a very interesting subject. I really hope we did it justice. I really prepared for this. You know, I had notes and everything.
I could tell.
Hard thing. I hope we got it right. I hope the discussion did it justice.
Well, that's the thing. The discussion can continue forever on those kind
exactly.
of topics.
Exactly. Go to sixgun.org/forum.
Yeah.
And go to the Linux Outlaws episode feedback forum. Look at the feedback for this episode. And, you know, tell us what you think there. I think with something like this, don't email us.
I was going to say, the problem is that...
Nobody, we can't, you know, we get so many emails, we can't put them all into feedback.
The best thing is a public discussion where everyone can chip in.
Exactly. If you go to the forum, everybody can see it, we can all discuss. There are people in the forum who know a lot more about certain things than we do.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll have their own feedback, so I think especially a topic like this really worth going there, sixgun.org/forum, and, you know, continue the discussion there.
Yeah, I reckon, I'm wondering now how many people by this stage, because it's going to be an incredibly long discussion, as we said, are still listening and are still awake. So if you are, congratulations, well done.
I hope quite a lot of people, because this was a very requested episode.
All right, cool.
We had on Identica, we had emails to the show email, I had personal emails, I had people in Minecraft telling me we should talk about this, in the IRC, everywhere. So lots of people requested this, and, you know, I took my sweet time you know, I had these requests for a month, and I took my time because I really wanted to do justice.
Yeah, get it right. Yeah, well, definitely. I think we've managed that. Another thing, slightly an off-topic thing that I think is quite funny is that this whole concept of, you talked about Minecraft there and miners and so on. You've now got people who will be talking about mining as in playing Minecraft, and people talking about mining as in mining bitcoins. You know. So I'm just wondering how many people get confused when one's.
We just need a plugin that you can somehow generate these hashes by actually mining stuff in Minecraft, and it should be like the internal game currency for
Minecraft.
At that
point, you're getting into some really philosophical shit about what's the real world and what's not. If you can actually dig
this is made for
world.
This. Yeah. I mean, all these games, World of Warcraft has its own currency. There are people doing gold farming. Generating World of Warcraft currency and then selling that.
Yeah, I know. And there's a lot of people making
in the
money,
future.
Yeah.
You can, like, there's people exchanging Second Life Linden dollars for Bitcoin.
That's right. Yeah.
So in the future, you can see all these games actually using Bitcoin, and you can see this virtual worlds like using virtual currency between each other, and you know, just blows your mind.
Yeah, it does. It is crazy stuff. So on that ponderous note, I think we'll leave you to I want to go and read some like Philip K. Dick or something now. It seems quite
I mean, this is, if you think about it, this is something right out of sci-fi. I mean,
exactly,
not out of Star Trek, where they don't have currency anymore and then they use like gold bars actually later. But this sounds like really something out of sci-fi.
Yeah, it does. So we're going to leave you with a song that you've picked. And it's a really cool song, actually. I like it. It fits the whole digital thing.
Yeah, this is some chip tunes. I thought if it's called Bitcoin, we need some music that kind of fits.
Yeah, great song, actually. I'm going to probably steal this for the next Rat Hole Radio. It's called Broken Kites, who apparently are British as well, according to Jumendo. I think. Oh no, United States. Sorry, they're in the United States. I should look closer. I was looking. The problem there, obviously I'm logged into Jumendo.
Yeah,
so it was telling me my language is English. And then
I've had that before. Well, in case you didn't know, your language is English.
Yeah. So anyway, this is by Broken Kites, and it's called Mechanize. And as I said, it's your pick. So if you like this,
I love the album title. The album title is Parameter Reallocation.
Very geeky stuff. And you can, we should just say, like, being a musician, I'm always very keen to point this out, but you can support the artists as well. Obviously, you can download this track for free off Jumendo, but on Jumendo, they've got some little, deluxe albums for sale through Jumendo. So if you really like them, then, you know, chuck them a couple of quid and make them feel good. Anyway, so as I said, that's my slightly biased musician point of view there. But check it out. Really great tune.
Yeah, so we'll see you again for another more regular show with news and everything. Mm-hmm. As I said, I hope you enjoyed this, and just keep thinking about Bitcoin, and it'll blow your mind. It's pretty amazing. We'll see where it takes us.
Yeah, my checklist would be read that book I told you about, watch V for Vendetta because that fits in nicely. An idea cannot be killed. Go and check out some of that stuff, and then you'll be in the right state of mind to understand Bitcoin.
Thank you for listening to Hacker Public Radio. For more information on the show and how to contribute your own shows, visit hackerpublicradio.org.